Today's Teisho will be on case 42 in the Mumon Kan. The girl comes out of samadhi. Once, in the old days, in the time of the world-honored one, Manjushri went to the assembly of the Buddhas and found that everyone had departed to his original dwelling place. Only a girl remained sitting in samadhi close to the Buddha's throne. Manjushri asked Shakyamuni Buddha, "Why can the girl get close to your throne while I cannot?" Shakyamuni Buddha said, "Bring her out of samadhi and ask her yourself." Manjushri walked around the girl three times, snapped his fingers, took her up to the Brahma heaven, and exerted all his miraculous powers to bring her out of meditation, but in vain. The world-honored one said, "Even 100,000 Manjushris cannot make her wake up." But down below, past 1,200 million lands as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, there is a bodhisattva named Momyo. He will be able to arouse her from her samadhi. Instantly, the bodhisattva Momyo emerged from the earth and made a bow to the world-honored one, who gave him his order. The bodhisattva Momyo went over to the girl and snapped his fingers once. At this, she came out of her samadhi. Mumon's comment: old Shakyamuni put a petty drama on the stage and failed to enlighten the masses. I want to ask you, Manjushri is the teacher of the seven Buddhas. Why couldn't he arouse the girl from her samadhi? How was it that Momyo, a bodhisattva in the beginner's stage, could do it? If you understand this intimately, you will enjoy Nagya's grand samadhi in the busiest activity of consciousness. One was successful, the other not. Oh, Mumon's verse. One was successful, the other not. One secured freedom of mind. One was successful, the other not. Both secured freedom of mind. Both secured freedom of mind. One in a god mask, the other in a devil mask. Even in defeat, a beautiful performance. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen today. On this beautiful fall day, today's Teisho is The Girl Comes Out of Samadhi. This is a sort of dreamlike scenario. It almost has like a fairy tale quality, like a long time ago in a land far away. Once in the old days, in the time of the world-honored one, that's another name for the Buddha, Manjushri went to the assembly of the Buddhas and found that everyone had departed to his original dwelling place. So, in early Buddhism, the Buddha, the sutras tended to focus on the Buddha as a historical person. These early Buddhist sutras were very interested in the Buddha as a human being. And they describe the Buddha's life in very matter-of-fact way. And mostly the early sutras are stories of the Buddha's encounter with various groups, various families or occupational groups, or like tradesmen, farmers, clans. You know, the Buddha lived at a time when people had lived on the land, like in extended families, in villages, right? And so he would go to a village and deliver a discourse, and people would ask him questions. And the early sutras record these conversations. There's even a sutra about where the Buddha talks about leaving his home, a very personal way, leaving his beloved wife and son, and going off to find enlightenment, and his difficulties, and the people he met, and so on. So the early sutras are very realistic. The later sutra, in fact, even the Buddha's death, there's even a sutra that describes his death, you know, and the Buddha was invited to dinner. Some very poor people invited him to dinner and served the Buddha some food which was spoiled. And it was probably food poisoning that killed him. The sutra suggests that the Buddha knew that the food was not necessarily good, but he ate it anyway. It was supposed to be some mushrooms. And he did it because he didn't want to offend these very poor people who had made their very best meal for him. So he kind of thought, well, if this is how I go, at least it will be helping these people, showing my care for them, and so on. And indeed, that's how he died. So the later sutras are much more almost like science fiction. You know, so some of the later sutras, we have the Buddha is now like a being who exists in many dimensions, and sometimes the sutras talk about the Buddha meeting other Buddhas. They all get together in some dimension and exchange enlightened insights. And so this sutra is. This koan is referring to like those sutras. Those sutras are really trying to say something a little different from the early sutras. The early Buddhists were interested in the Buddha as a man, but the later sutras were really interested in the psychological dimension of the mind. So when you get these fantastic scenes, it's really like a dream. Like a dream world, or like a fairy tale. It's a truth. It's a sort of like symbolic truth or psychological insight. Like a psychological insight is the point of the stories. So here, in the olden days of the Buddha, Manjushri went to the assembly of the Buddhas, this place where all the Buddhas have gathered. But he found that all the Buddhas had left. Each Buddha had gone off to his own world, his own planet, basically. And only a girl remained, sitting in samadhi close to the Buddha's throne. Again, in the early sutras, the Buddha didn't sit on a throne. But in the later sutras, the Buddha is like magnified or made into this symbol of the enlightened mind in yourself, or enlightened awareness. So in this story, only the girl remains sitting in samadhi close to the Buddha's throne. Manjushri, who is supposed to be a deeply enlightened bodhisattva, in fact, the bodhisattva of wisdom, the wisest of all the Buddha's students is Manjushri. Manjushri asked the Buddha, "Why can this girl get near to your throne while I cannot?" So this is like an interesting scenario. Because, in many countries, in all countries, all human societies almost, until recently, women had a second-class status. And this is, of course, regrettably true all over the world, even today. So it's actually rather recent that women have been able to own property. You know, in the West, 200 years ago, a woman couldn't own her own property. Only recently have women had the right to vote, and other sorts of legal rights under law. That's quite recent. And I really think that our time is remembered in a positive way, it will be because of this is the time when women began to be freed from all these prejudices and all this discrimination. And it's like age-old discrimination, but it's slowly starting to end, you know. There are nations in the world where women are presidents and prime ministers. We have women on our Supreme Court. Many countries are far ahead of us in the United States in that regard. This is like a real historical, very important development, you know. I just went next door, in the room next to us, I noticed some people were organizing some event. And I peeked my head in, and there were some young women there. And I said, "What's going on?" And she said, "We're having a meeting, a sorority event." And I said, "Are you guys going to make a lot of noise?" And she smiled, and you know, like, "Yes." And I said, "Would you mind moving to another room?" And she said, "No," just like that, "No." And I said, "You wouldn't mind?" And she said, "No." It was like not an issue. Now, I have to tell you, I have the feeling if that was a fraternity, those guys would fight to the death before they moved, you know. It's true. I mean, I'm a male. I understand, you know. That would be their territory. They would have left their scent marks on the corners of the room. So, you know, the fact... I was actually incredibly moved by this person's generosity and her lack of territoriality and aggression, right? You know, I said to her basically, "I have a need. Would you accommodate my need, basically?" And she said yes without even asking who I was. I'm this old man standing there in my bare feet, right? And I asked her to do this, and she did it for me. Or I think she did it for me. We'll see in a little while. But the fact is, she treated me with respect. I could have been a lunatic, you know, for all she knows. So you know, that kind of kindness and generosity isn't always encountered in humans of either gender. But I do feel that, we're going through a wonderful moment in history where people who have been, or half the human race, actually a little bit more than half the human race, has been treated terribly, abominably, and worse than animals, and are now finally coming into their own, and I hope with my whole being that this process continues. And I think it's one something to be really proud of, that, in like the Zen tradition, women now play a very prominent role. In Taiwan, there are more nuns than monks, actually, right now. And in a number of other countries, that's true, too. And some of the most respected figures in the tradition, like the Zen tradition, are women now. So I think that's wonderful. So this is a story about from a time, you know, this koan was written down in maybe in the 11th century, and it goes back to an earlier time, maybe the 7th century, when women were definitely second-class citizens, you know. So women couldn't own property. Generally speaking, women couldn't really even determine who they would marry, right? So anyway, Manjushri is supposed to be the Buddha's most advanced disciple, right? And he's the bodhisattva, or the realized being of wisdom. So he's supposed to be really special, right? And we're told, you know, he arrives late at this event. All the Buddhas were gathering on some planet, I guess, or in some dimension. They'd all come from their worlds where each of them was the Buddha. And they'd all gone home. So he gets there late, right? He arrives late at the party. And all the Buddhas at the Buddha party have left. And he comes over to see the Buddha, but the Buddha is sitting there, and where in his seat is a girl. See, you know, it's easy not to appreciate what this means. I mean, first of all, you know, in these times, it would have been very rare for a woman to be by herself. You know, so she's there without any chaperone. She's there without any, her father's not with her. Her brother's not with her. I was just reading about Saudi Arabia, which just sounds like it, I mean, with all due respect, like a terrible place. And this woman who has like a PhD, she said, she can't go to the store without her brother driving her in the car. So, you know, this is sort of from a time when this was the case. So, you know, here's a woman by herself with the Buddha. And she's sitting in Manjushri's place, in his special seat next to the Buddha. You know, he's the Buddha's right-hand man, and there's this girl in his seat. You're supposed to be a little skeptical about Manjushri. You know, he's sort of like upset that this person's in his seat. Manjushri said to the Buddha, "Why can the girl get to the Buddha's throne and I cannot? I'm the great Manjushri. What is this girl doing here?" It's like almost like, what, has the world gone mad? You know. And so the Buddha basically says, you know, he doesn't say it, but implied in this whole story is, you know, you have something to learn. You have, first of all, he's implied in the story is, Manjushri, you have a problem with women, number one. But also, you know, you have a problem with yourself, right? You know, you're a mountain of pride and arrogance and self-regard. So Shakyamuni, the Buddha says to him, sort of a challenge, "Well, you're the great Manjushri, bring her out of her samadhi and ask her yourself." So Manjushri has these magical powers in these sutras. All the Buddha beings have magical powers, which are really just expressions of our human abilities, right? Manjushri walked around the girl three times, snapped his fingers, took her up to the highest heaven. He exerted all her miraculous powers to bring her out of her meditation, but in vain. He can't do it. She's still in deep samadhi. So it's like, you know, then the Buddha says, the world-honored one said, "You know, Manjushri, even 100,000 Manjushris couldn't wake her up. But down below, past 1,200 million lands as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges," in other words, you know, there are millions of planets, there are millions of universes. In the Buddhist way of thinking, there's millions of planets and there's millions of universes, and we're just one little planet in an infinite cosmos. That's the Buddhist way of thinking about things. And he says, there are so many planets, there's 100 million planets. They're more numerous than the sands of the Ganges. And down there somewhere, there's a bodhisattva named Momyo. And he will be able to arouse her from samadhi. And as soon as the Buddha says this, boom, out of the earth, out of the ground springs this little bodhisattva named Momyo. And he makes a bow to the Buddha. And the Buddha says, "Please wake her up." And the bodhisattva goes over to the girl, snaps her fingers once, and at this she comes out of samadhi. So this is the story. So, you know, I guess we all have our Manjushri-like aspects, right? I mean, all of us have kind of innate wisdom. All of us. The Buddhist teaching is that wisdom is not really something people acquire. It's something we fundamentally are. You know, so you can read all the books in the world about wisdom and not possess wisdom or not embody wisdom. And if you do that, you know, you're only looking for what you already possess. In consciousness itself, or consciousness itself is fundamentally enlightened. That's the Buddhist teaching. And a consciousness itself is fundamentally wisdom. Fundamentally wisdom. So, you know, sometimes if you overthink things, you mess things up. Sometimes if you just trust yourself, you know, you'll be delighted with the outcome. You know, it's often the case. I'm a teacher, you know. And when I first started teaching, I used to plan my lessons out meticulously. You know, so I would have almost like a little script, and I could say, you know, like 45 minutes into the class, roughly, this is what we'll be doing. You know, this is where the conversation will be going. And so I was as a young teacher, I wanted to do a good job, and I really overplanned. And so what would happen to me very often was I would come into class with like my script in my head and my lecture notes. And then the class would totally deviate from what I had planned, you know. And as it would deviate, I would get more, I realized after a while that I was getting more and more tense, right? More and more tense. And in my department at that time, if you were a junior faculty, a senior faculty was supposed to come and observe you, which was a terrible experience. So, this very senior person would come and sit in the back of the room. And, you know, if the students weren't on that day, it was agonizing. You know, some days you go into class and you tell a joke and nobody laughs. Some days you go in and you pitch a question and nobody takes your question. And then you rephrase it and still nobody takes it, you know. If you have a very senior person sitting there, it's like your supervisor is sitting there watching you. It's agonizing. It's like one joke falls to the ground after another. The students aren't responding. Nobody seems to know anything. You know, it's a nightmare. And I actually got a negative review from one professor. He said there wasn't enough closure in this class, meaning, you know, at the end of the class, I didn't tell the students what they were supposed to learn. So, I realized, you know, teaching is becoming really unpleasant for me. I'm supposed to be a professor, but I actually hate teaching because I'm so tense. You know, so eventually it occurred to me that I didn't have to control the situation, you know. I could actually just ask questions and see where we went, you know, see where it went. And when you do that, the class goes like lightning a lot of the time. You know, if you pitch questions and you just follow the natural curiosity of the group, and, you know, it usually works out really well. And you can keep, you know, if you have like a bunch of, instead of having a plan, if you just have a bunch of questions you can pitch to your students, you know, if some of those questions really get them thinking, and you know, by the end of, say, 80 minutes, it's not where you planned, but it's a really interesting place to be. And everybody's participated, right? So you know, this is definitely how I teach now. And I actually love to go into the classroom because I'm not tense. I'm not worried. And for some reason, I'm able to respond on my feet very quickly and ably. And my students do well, too. So that's sort of like natural wisdom, right? That's sort of like our natural wisdom. You know, when we over-prepare, when we overthink, we're not having enough faith in ourselves and in the situation. you know, in the situation, there's a kind of wisdom that emerges from a situation. There's a kind of order that emerges in a situation. You know, I had a lunch meeting the other day with somebody I had never met, and I just had a topic. I didn't have any big agenda to discuss, but it turned into a wonderful discussion. I couldn't have planned it. It was just the dynamics of this person and myself getting together and talking. You know, so there's a wisdom that unfolds naturally if we don't try to control things. You know, it's the same thing with many other things, marriage. You know, I've been married for 40 years, or I will be married for 40 years in about 4 months. And when when we first got married, you know, we read all these books about marriage and relationships, you know. And, you know, we each were trying to sort of live out these scripts. And it made the whole relationship thing feel very oppressive, you know. And like we were constantly screwing up, you know. And I guess we probably gave those books away 30 years ago, you know. If you just trust the process, there's a kind of natural wisdom. So, a lot of Zen practice is learning to trust the process, learning to trust the natural wisdom. And it's very important to have faith in yourself. You know, when you sit down on the cushion, you don't know what's going to happen. But sometimes you sit down on the cushion and it's like, wow, where did that come from? That was so wonderful. Or if you're working with a koan, you know, you think, I'll never answer this koan. And then, you know, you sit down on the cushion and all of a sudden it's like the doors open up. You know, sometimes I do a lot of writing and I'll be stuck and I'll go and meditate and go to sleep and I'll get up the next day and it's like these great ideas come out. And it's like, where did those come from? And it's not me, it's the process, you know. So, you know, in a way, Manjushri represents this natural wisdom, you know, that we all have. But, you know, there's another aspect to our, like, personality, you know, and that is that, you know, there's always something that we are afraid of or that we want to keep, you know, it's like we like trusting the process, but there's always something that makes us, that we'd rather not deal with. You know, we'd rather not deal with, because it puts our self-esteem at risk. So it puts our self-esteem at risk. You know, there's something we haven't, you know, maybe dealt with in ourselves that it's like we'll trust the process to a point, but there's something in ourselves we don't want to risk because it could cost us our self-esteem. I don't know if that's making any sense, but a lot of the time we get closed up in ourselves because there's things we just are afraid of doing, you know, or afraid of becoming, you know. So we don't try new things, and we don't reach out to certain kinds of people, you know. In a way, this koan is sort of about that, right? I mean, it's about Manjushri is an awakened being, but there are limits to his awakening, and you know, we see his limits when he encounters this quote unquote girl sitting in front of the Buddha. Suddenly, he realizes, you know, I have a great deal of anxiety about my status. You know, or he hasn't learned this yet, but we can see it. He has a great deal of anxiety about his status, his reputation, and the way the Buddha thinks of him. And he is afraid of the girl taking his place. He's also afraid of the girl because he sees her as lowly. You know, so the girl is what he doesn't want to become like. This is, I think, really deep psychological insight. You know, I think it doesn't take long for little boys to realize that little girls are not their equals in a society. You know, and I think little boys pick that up, you know. Even today, you know, where we have a much more equal society, you know, I read educational journals, and apparently teachers are much more supportive of boys than girls in the classroom. Isn't that interesting? So, you know, if a boy is struggling, often even a teacher who happens to be a woman will help the boy more than she would help a little girl in the classroom. And this also goes for race. Interestingly, teachers of both black teachers and white teachers are much less tolerant of acting out students when the students are students of color. Isn't that interesting? Teachers who are, you know, maybe even feminists, you know, they will cut a lot more slack to the boys in the room than to the little girls in the room. And they will definitely help a little boy who's struggling much more than they'll help a little girl who's struggling. And in fact, you know, when they see a girl who's struggling, they might feel embarrassed, you know, because they didn't want to be the girl who was struggling. It's sort of like, get your act together, sister, you're letting us down. A little bit, maybe, right? So there's definitely these prejudices in society, even today. I think little boys learn fairly early on that it's sort of their world a little bit. You know, when my brother was a kid, he was terrified of having anything that might be girlish about him. This sounds so weird, you know. I myself, I've talked about this before, I actually owned dolls, you know. And it caused anxiety to everybody, but I actually didn't mind owning dolls. But my brother was like phobic about, my brother's name is Peter. One of my father's professors at college was a man named Beckwith. So my father named my brother, he gave him the name Peter Beckwith. His middle name was, my father named my brother after his professor, Beckwith. And my father actually used to call my brother Beck. Don't ask me why, right? But this is a little bit like that song. You probably don't know this song. There's a song about a boy named Sue, about a father who named his son Sue, and he would get into fights all the time. Well, my brother's middle name was Beckwith, and my brother used to call him Beck. And when my brother went to school and he said, my name is Beck, people, you know, the boys just, it was Becky, right? And this, for my brother, this was mortifying. Right, absolutely horrible. It was like he couldn't. It was like he wanted to throw himself over a cliff. He was just a little boy. He became sort of phobic about having anything that might be vaguely feminine about his personality, and I think this is related to really a fear of losing your status. Right, you know, I think my brother unconsciously realized, you know, boys are better than girls. Boys are treated better than girls. Boys have a kind of power girls don't have. You know, so he didn't want to be anything like a girl, see? I mean, this is my theory anyway. But I see this dynamic even now sometimes with kids and with other people too. You know, years ago, I used to teach for the Educational Opportunities Program in Washington State, and I used to teach a lot of Chicano students who came from Eastern Washington. Their parents were agricultural workers, and I remember having a class of people who were basically mostly the children of migrants from Mexico, And there was this one guy in the class named Rick who looked very, very white, you know, very Anglo-Saxon face. And there was a girl in the class named Lily who looked like an Indian. And one day we were having a conversation, and I said, "Oh, Rick, I like that point. It's very much like the point Lily made." And Rick said, "Lily, oh, you mean that little Indian girl." He was saying, basically, in Mexico, Native Americans, who we call Indians, have a lower status than people who look more European. So he was saying, "I am not like that girl. I am one of you. She is one of them." Right? You know. So that he was afraid that I would think he was like Lily, a Mexican, an Indian, an Indio, Indio. See. So this is a very human dynamic. It's very painful and difficult to see, but it's something probably all of us do. Right? We all have something that we feel that way about, you know. We all have our untouchable. We all have identity or kind of a person that we don't want to be associated with or like, right? So I think this koan is getting at something really important, you know. You know, we all want to be good people. We all want to be Manjushri, and in our desire for excellence, you know, to be good, you know, we often close doors on other people, you know, because we're sort of like afraid that's a part of us we have not been able to deal with, or we have tried to leave behind. You know, I often work with new teachers who are graduate students, and every once in a while you'll get a graduate student who's a new teacher. I'll be working with him, and I'll read like the comments this teacher will make on student papers, and they're really nasty comments, or like the you know really nasty or aggressive. So, you know, the graduate student will write on a student paper, no, this is a complete misreading. You know, you're this is totally off, you know, or what's wrong with you, you know, question mark. Yeah, I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding, I swear. It's why we have to supervise, these people. And you think, where the hell is this coming from? You know, where is this coming from? You know, this is probably coming from a lot of places. But you know, when you are a good student, you learn not to be a bad student. You know, you don't want to be like the bad students. You know, so part of becoming a good student is never acting like a bad student. You never want to act like the person who's clueless. You know, you always want to have the right answer. You know, you always want to be the person who did the homework. And so, you know, when this teacher is confronting people who are clueless and they maybe didn't do the homework or they don't have the right skill set, you know, anger. And believe me, that anger has been directed at himself long before it was directed at this poor student he happens to be in charge of this semester. You know, so this is an interesting dynamic. You know, Manjushri is trying to be excellent, but often when we're trying to be excellent, if we think about it, it's at the expense of someone else who's threatening to us because we know in our hearts, you know, we're kind of like that person. So, you know, this is definitely going to be something that becomes more obvious after the election, you know, or during the election, after the election. You know, I mean, every time I actually find, you know, what's happening politically really terrifying, you know. And every once in a while, I find myself just burning with rage at Trump and his supporters, you know. And I think some of that's good, you know, because they truly are terrifying. But, you know, on the other hand, I was just reading this wonderful essay by a woman I really like. She's a social scientist named Arlie Hochschild. And she went around the Midwest, I think primarily in the Midwest, talking to very poor working white people. And their world is really totally falling apart. And they're all Trump supporters, you know. And, you know, they really live like this very unhappy hand-to-mouth life. And, you know, they worked in factories, and now the factories have closed, you know. They basically have three jobs, and they can't pay their bills, you know, this kind of thing. And, you know, I find myself, you know, I feel somewhat, you know, when I read this, I actually feel a little ashamed because I was so quick to, you know, basically hate these people, you know, who are frightening to me. You know, and I think this is a real challenge, you know, to be able to realize, you know, that this is really, you know, what we fear, reaching out to what we fear, or embracing what we fear, or what we can't, you know, what we're afraid of, is really, in a way we become awake. It's really the way we become awake. You know, I'm not saying I'm going to vote for Trump. That's not what I'm saying. But I become a more closed up person when I don't understand or try to understand people who are unlike myself, you know. And reading this article about these people, it was really deeply moving to me. You know, because they are really, I have worked all my life not to be like these people. You know, I tried to get the best grades in my class. I tried to go to a good university. I went to graduate school. I did everything possible not to be like these people. And, you know, when I find myself afraid of them or hating them, you know, I it's a really complicated relationship, but, you know, actually understanding them is really important to my own happiness and awakening. And, of course, helping them would be even more important, right? And nobody has helped them, you know. So, you know, in Zen practice, you know, all Zen practice, you could say, in a way, is like encountering the things in yourself that you don't want to deal with. You know, when you're working with a koan, very often the koan takes you to a place where, you know, you don't want to be, right? I mean, we become wise by encountering things in ourselves that we've closed off. You know, I can remember a koan I was working on, and I won't tell you the koan because maybe we'll work on it. But I was working on the koan, and I thought I had the answer, and I went in to see Genki Roshi, and he said, "Oh, that's not the answer. That you're like a million miles from it," you know. And I went back to my cushion, and I was hopping mad. I mean, I actually sat there thinking, this Zen is shit, you know. This is a fraud, you know. Genki Roshi is a fraud, you know. I mean, I was just, It was all I could do not to walk out. I was just so mad I could scream. And I remember going into the Dokusan later, and I said to Genki Roshi, after you said that to me, I was so mad I could scream. And he and Webb, who was his translator, they both burst into laughter. Because, of course, that was the answer to the koan. You know, that was my answer to the koan. You know, I hadn't wanted to see that part of myself. You know, when I was practicing Zen, I wanted to be a manjushri. I wanted to be a kind, compassionate, loving person, always unflappable, always generous. And that koan put me face to face with a part of myself that, you know, I don't know, could do some really terrible things. You know, in myself, there is definitely, there is an angry person too, right? And I think that dealing with anger, one way to deal with anger is to try to wall it off. But then it becomes uncontrollable, right? It comes out at the darndest times, right? You know, I worked with a person who had a real anger problem, you know. And I actually tried to talk to him about it, and he literally said, "I am like the kindest. Are you out of your mind? I'm the kindest person in the world. You bastard, you know, you idiot, you know." But he really took it personally. You know, he's really upset. Me angry, you know. And indeed. Other people are in my department are well aware that this guy has massive, and he's done nothing about it, right? It's the part of himself he doesn't, you know, the more he is aware of his anger, the more he retreats away from it and it sort of separates it from himself. But, you know, you can't deal with your anger if you do that. You have to realize there's an angry person in here too. You know, among the many people in my head, one of them is a really angry person sometime. If you can accept that, you can probably deal with your anger much better. You know, everybody has such a person in his head or in her head. It sounds like a cliche, but you kind of have to make a place for that angry person in your heart. If you can forgive yourself for being angry, you can. It's half the battle, really. You know, if you can forgive, you admit you can be angry, and you can forgive yourself for being angry. You know, you're really there. You know. So Manjushri is a good guy, but he's not done his cultivation. Basically, he has a lot of pride, and he's afraid of maybe this girl represents a vulnerability, or maybe it represents somebody who doesn't have a lot of social power. Maybe the girl, represents being disrespected. The person who wakes the girl up is Momyo. And the koan tells us Momyo isn't a great bodhisattva. He just got started. But he can wake the girl up because, you know, basically he doesn't worry about being the great manjushri. He's willing to make mistakes. He's willing, you know, there's nothing special about Momyo. He's not trying to be anything special. So he, I think, is able to help the girl in a way that Manjushri can't. The world-honored one said, even 100,000 Manjushris cannot make her wake up. But down below, past 1,200 million lands as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, there is the Bodhisattva Momyo. He will be able to arouse her from his samadhi. Instantly, the Bodhisattva Momyo emerged from the earth and made a bow to the world-honored one, who gave him his order. The Bodhisattva went over to the girl, snapped his fingers once. At this, she came out of samadhi. Mumon's verse. One was successful, the other was not. Both secured freedom of mind. One in a god mask, the other in a devil's mask. Even in defeat, a beautiful performance.